Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hey y'all, I'm Mandy.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back, Monsterinos.
I like that.
I came up with.
I like it.
I don't have anything to share this week. Nothing new.
Nope.
Except Mandy and I got some voodoo dark angel tattoos.
Yes.
We still have two more to get. And we got our new sweaters.
I know. I'm excited.
Yep. We got to take a picture in front of our little ghoul thingy over here.
Yeah.
Yep. And we got masks to put these on.
I know. I see it.
Yeah. We can put those on for the picture.
Okay. Woo! We can do it.
Okay. Anyway. So on Friday, we dove back into the true crime of it all with the Toolbox Killers. This week, we're sticking with the true crime world and delving into a case that shook Canada to its core. A story of innocence, betrayal, and evil hidden behind a perfect facade.
Mm.
So, last week was rough. Mm-hmm. Okay. This one isn't much easier. But I promise the next three are going to be so worth having to suffer through these. And honestly, this is kind of why we're all truly here anyway. So, we're just giving everyone what they came for.
Right.
So with all of that, if you're ready to suffer through this one with me and our listeners, we're going to dive into it.
Let's do it.
Okay. Look at the photos. They could be ripped from a catalog. The picture of 1980s suburban success. Paul Bernardo. Handsome, towering with a bright smile. And Carla Homolka. Blonde, beautiful. The girl next door. They were young, successful, and perfectly matched. They were the couple you'd wave at from across the fence. They were, in the parlance of the time, the perfect Ken and Barbie. The terrifying truth, however, was that behind that blindingly attractive facade lay a realm of sadistic violence and depravity that Canadians and the world had never truly conceived of. The Ken and Barbie killer nickname became a stark, chilling metaphor for the way evil can hide in plain sight. And the epicenter of that evil was a seemingly innocuous suburban property in St. Catharines. Their home at 4283 Dorchester Road, now infamously known as the House of Horrors. This is the story of two predators who found each other, turning their home into a torture chamber and their relationship into a path of murder. It's a deep dive into the crimes that stole the lives of three young women, including Carla's own sister. This is a tragedy that shattered the notion of safety in quiet suburban Canada, particularly for the families of 14-year-old Leslie Mahaffey and 15-year-old Kristen French. In today's episode, we're going to trace the disturbing trajectory of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. We'll examine Bernardo's terrifying origins as the Scarborough rapist and how Carla willingly joined his reign of terror. We will detail the abductions and murders, crimes so grotesque they defy easy description. But the real heart of this episode, the part that continues to haunt the Canadian justice system, is the shocking aftermath, the discovery of the horrifying videotapes and the infamous deal with the devil plea bargain. All that allowed Carla Homolka to walk free after just 12 years. This is a story of evil, but also the profound failure of justice. This is the Ken and Barbie Killers, A Deal with the Devil.
I can't wait to hear it.
It's a good one. As we get into it, I'm sure you'll recognize it.
Right.
So to understand the full scope of this story, we must first look back at the individuals who formed this lethal partnership. For Paul Bernardo, his violence was not a sudden turn. It was a steady escalating pattern. Born in 1964, Paul Bernardo grew up in Scarborough, a sprawling suburb east of Toronto. His childhood was spent in an affluent upper middle class environment with a father working for a major corporation like IBM Canada. Despite this comfortable setting, Paul was known for an aggressive and entitled personality, often nicknamed Tex in high school for his bravado and manipulative nature. Between 1987 and 1990, he committed at least 14 documented rapes, and countless other assaults. a spree marked by his escalating brutality and his chilling efficiency, earning him the moniker the Scarborough Rapist. The crucial failure here is that despite hundreds of leads, police failed to connect his escalating pattern of sexual violence to the charming, athletic man walking their streets. While the investigation floundered and the monster walked free, he found the one person who wouldn't just tolerate his darkness, but willingly embrace it and join in on his reign of terror. When he met Carla Homolka in October of 1987, she was just 17 and working at a local pet food store in Scarborough. Carla Leanne Homolka, born in 1970, was a veterinary assistant whose vulnerability Bernardo expertly exploited. He systematically isolated her, controlled her finances, and became physically and emotionally abusive. He was reportedly furious that Carla was not a virgin, and he used her sexual past as a tool for constant degradation and emotional abuse, reducing her self-worth to the point of complete broken obedience. In a chilling foreshadowing of the horrors to come, Bernardo actually rendered Carla unconscious using a powerful anesthetic called halothane before he presented her with an engagement ring. This was her initiation into his world of non-consensual violence. Carla was not an innocent drawn into this darkness, though. She became a willing and even eager participant. She began filming their sexual encounters and assisting Bernardo in his fantasies. As they moved in together in St. Catharines, their shared depravity escalated from fantasy to practice. They had found their sick equilibrium. And tragically, their attention would turn inward toward Carla's own family. Carla's younger sister, Tammy Homolka, was a frequent visitor to their new home. Paul was fixated on Tammy. She represented the, quote, pure victim he craved, a stark contrast to who Carla was, whom he continually degraded for not being a virgin. This obsession culminated in a plan to assault Tammy as a perverse gift. This abuse climaxed tragically on December 24th of 1990, as Carla sought to prove her loyalty and submit her place with Paul by offering him Tammy's virginity. Carla, motivated by her desperate need to please Bernardo, stole the powerful aesthetic halothane and fraudulently obtained sleeping pills, which is halicin, from her job at the veterinary clinic. She administered the substances to her 15-year-old sister, Tammy, along with alcohol and a rum and eggnog cocktail, causing her to lose consciousness in the basement of the family home. That was also the family room. The couple's plan was to sexually assault the unconscious girl, with Carla actively assisting in filming the entire act. Tragically, though, while sedated and subjected to the halothane-soaked cloth, Tammy began to choke on her own vomit. In a panic, the couple scrambled to hide the evidence. They cleaned, did laundry, dressed Tammy, who had had a chemical burn on her face from the halothane, and then moved her back to her bedroom before calling 911. They told police a fabricated story about Tammy getting too drunk at a family party and then passing out. Tammy died that Christmas Eve at the hospital without regaining consciousness. The municipal coroner, unaware of the drugs administered, accepted the couple's story, ruling the death accidental. The successful cover-up and Tammy's death fundamentally changed the dynamic between Paul and Carla. For Bernardo, the lack of consequences for murder was an extreme validation, fueling his sadistic impulses. For Carla, the secret of her complicity became Paul's ultimate tool of control. He used the threat of exposing her role in her sister's death to blackmail and enslave her. Carla's dependence on Paul, born of her desperation and his systematic emotional abuse, made her cling to him even tighter. The immediate aftermath of Tammy's death demonstrated the catastrophic depth of their depravity. Bernardo, reeling from the fact that he got away from murder, insisted that Carla later dressed up in Tammy's clothes, and they would then go on to have sex on the dead girl's bed.
What the fuck?
Mm-hmm. A disgusting attempt to reenact the crime. Yeah. This profound lack of remorse and the successful cover-up of their first murder validated Bernardo's belief in his own invincibility and heightened his desire for escalation. Now, ignoring the cries of her own grieving parents and utterly consumed by her need to maintain her bond with Paul, Carla pushed ahead with their wedding plans. So despite the grieving family suggesting that they postpone the wedding due to the funeral costs and their wish to grieve privately, Paula proceeded with a lavish wedding. In February of 1991, the couple moved into this home, which this is the house that would later become known as the Crime House or the House of Horrors. This new private domain, like I said, eliminated the risk of anyone coming in, interrupting them, and it gave them all of the necessary isolation that they needed. This quiet suburban house would soon become a literal torture chamber. What happened in those 4 months between their move and the start of the next murder? Well, what you would expect. They settled into their new home, but they were also testing the water of their shared criminal life as well. Bernardo had lost his job in accounting, and so now he was making money by smuggling cigarettes across the U.S.-Canada border. This provided him with the cash and the cover for long periods away from home. But more sinisterly, during this time, Carla, who had worked at an animal clinic, stole the anesthetic agent, Halothane. She would also provide him with tranquilizers that she also had access to. These were the tools for their new partnership, the means to subdue their next victim. In spring of 1991, they carried out at least one additional sexual assault involving another young woman, a hitchhiker that Bernardo had picked up and assaulted inside the house. This confirmed for them that they could use their home as their personal prison and torture site. They were preparing for their next, more elaborate and fatal crime. Then, in June of 1991, they found their target. This victim was 14-year-old Leslie Mahaffey from Burlington, Ontario. Leslie had been attending a wake for a friend. In the early hours of the morning, she had been unable to get into her locked home. She wasn't home by the time she was supposed to be. Her dad locked her out. While she was standing outside alone, Paul Bernardo had spotted her and lured her to his car with the false pretenses of giving her a cigarette. He then forced her into the vehicle and drove her to the couple's residence in St. Catharines. Leslie was held captive in the house for about 24 hours. This confinement was a shared campaign of terror. Leslie was locked in a spare room and repeatedly subjected to sexual assault and torture. Carla Homolka was an active participant. She provided the couple with tranquilizers from her job, which were used to drug and subdue the teenagers. The couple would then document their crimes with videotapes that were later discovered showing Leslie was held hostage and assaulted by both Paul and Carla. In a horrifying detail, she was even given a teddy bear to hold onto between these bouts of abuse.
That's fucking sick.
Leslie Mahaffey was murdered sometime on June 16th. Bernardo had strangled the 14-year-old using an electric cord. Following the murder, the final shocking act of disposal took place. The couple moved Leslie's body to the basement where Bernardo used a circular saw to dismember her remains. He then encased the parts in heavy concrete blocks, which were dumped into Lake Gibson. 2 weeks later, the remains were tragically discovered. And on that very same day, June 29th, 1991, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka proceeded with their lavish, perfect wedding.
They're sick, dude.
Yep. We're not even done yet.
I know.
The extreme juxtaposition of their celebrity public facade and the unspeakable crime they had just committed is the central horror of this case. On the outside, they were perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But on the inside, there were some fucked up individuals.
Right.
Now, in the 10 months that followed, the couple attempted to normalize their lives, but the hell within their home only grew. This period was one of sustained violence, domestic duress, and ongoing sexual sadism, all while the police were quietly looking for a killer. The first and most coercive development was the increasing brutality within the marriage. Paul Bernardo's abuse of Carla escalated dramatically, becoming almost daily. Carla would later testify that her relationship, which she claimed was already a, quote, loveless sham, became a, quote, hideous nightmare. After Mahaffey's death, she endured escalating physical and psychological assaults, testifying about being spat on, having her food contaminated, and suffering beatings with objects ranging from flashlights to pieces of firewood. Her defense would later argue that her compliance was a sign of, quote, survival strategies, characteristic of a, quote, compliant victim of a sexual sadist. The abuse culminated in a particularly severe beating in December of 1992, where Bernardo left her with severe facial bruising, including two black eyes. The psychological torture was constant. Homolka testified that Bernardo forced her to endure profoundly humiliating acts. At one point, making her eat his feces.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So gross. Such a gross word. Telling her, quote, I could do it and get it over with, or I could get beaten and then do it. This terror, coupled with the threat of exposure, was the iron lock that kept Carla in place. Second, their predatory behavior continued. In August of 1991, just 2 months after their wedding, they had targeted a teenager only known as Jane Doe. Carla was essential to this plan. She lured the girl, an acquaintance of hers, to their St. Catherine's bungalow for a supposed girls' night out. Carla then actively participated in drugging the victim, typically with excess doses of powerful tranquilizers, which she had fraudulently, again, obtained and stolen from her work. This rendered the teenager deeply unconscious or semi-conscious. Both Paul and Carla then sexually assaulted her, with Carla visibly on videotapes, actively assisting and participating. The incident nearly became a third homicide. In the midst of the assault, the victim stopped breathing, a near-fatal reaction to the drug overdose. Carla was forced to call 911, but even in that moment of crisis, she carefully provided a false story to the operator, concealing the drugging and sexual assault. Jane Doe survived, and in December of 1992, she actually confronted both Paul and Carla about being forced to have sex with Paul. A confrontation the couple simply dismissed.
Damn.
Yep. The existence of the videotaped evidence, however, would later completely shatter Carla's initial claim of being merely a terrified, passive victim. Finally, Paul was increasingly occupied by criminal activities to support their lifestyle. Having lost his job, like I mentioned, he was now heavily focused on cigarette smuggling across the border, often forcing Carla to accompany him. Homolka also stated that he made her drive with him as he cruised various southern Ontario streets actively hunting for potential victims. This 10-month period, therefore, was not a lull, but a horrific cycle of domestic sadism.
This one's rough.
Mm-hmm.
You have to watch. I'll tell you in a minute.
The search for a victim ended in April of 1992. 10 months after Leslie Mahaffey's murder, the escalation finally led to their next victim, 15-year-old Kristen French. Kristen Dawn French, born May 10th of 1976, was a well-liked sophomore at Holly Cross Secondary School and the second daughter of Doug and Donna French. She was known to be bright, athletic, and helpful. Her family was well-regarded in the St. Catharines community, a sense of suburban normalcy that made her eventual fate all more shocking. On the afternoon of April 16, 1992, Kristen was walking home from school. This time, the abduction was a calculated team effort, witnessed by several people, though they were too late to intervene. The couple cruising in their car spotted her. Carla Homolka played the essential role of the decoy, getting out of the car near the entrance of the Grace Lutheran Church parking lot, holding a map and feigning distress. And Kristen approached to help the seemingly lost woman. Paul Bernardo, armed with a knife, snuck up behind from a blind side and forced her into the car. Carla was not passive. She immediately played the role of guard, restraining Kristen by holding down her hair in the front seat as they drove the terrified girl back to their dark bungalow. Kristen was held in captivity for 3 days, from Thursday, April 16th, until Sunday, April 19th, in the home of Paul and Carla. The details later confirmed by Carla's testimony and the eventual discovery of the tapes were horrific. During that period, Kristen was subjected to sustained torture. She was beaten, sexually assaulted by both Paul and Carla, and subjected to days of degradation. In an effort to keep her subdued and compliant, the couple forced her to drink large amounts of alcohol. As was their sickening pattern, Bernardo and Homolka videotaped their actions throughout the entire 3 days. The existence of these tapes proved Carla's active participation in the assaults and the torture, a fact that would later implode her defense. In an ultimate act of psychological cruelty, the couple allegedly forced the captive, Kristen, to watch the videotaped assault of their previous victim, Leslie Mahaffey, forcing her to confront the grim reality of her situation. Despite the terror, Kristen French demonstrated an astonishing spirit of defiance. According to later testimony, she refused to fully cooperate with her captors. In one moment of incredible courage, she challenged Paul Bernardo, stating, quote, "Some things are worth dying for." She also reportedly looked at Paul and said, quote, "I don't know how your wife can stand being around you."
Damn, get it, girl.
Right. Kristen French was murdered on April 19, 1992. Amolka testified that Bernardo strangled Kristen with the same electrical cord that he had allegedly used on Leslie Mahaffey. After she was dead, the couple carefully washed the body and cut off her hair in a deliberate attempt to impede forensic identification. The final act of profound normalization came immediately after the murder. The couple left Kristen's body in their home and then drove to Carla's parents' house to attend a family Easter dinner.
They're fucked in the head, dude.
Yep. After this chillingly normal evening, Bernardo drove to Burlington and dumped Kristen's naked body in a ditch. Kristen French's remains were discovered on April 30th, 1992, in a rural area located less than a kilometer from where Leslie Mahaffey's dismembered remains had been found. This grim discovery in such immediate proximity eliminated any doubt and confirmed the worst fears of investigators and the public. The Niagara region was now dealing with a calculated and escalating serial killer. The investigation into the Mahaffey and French murders, quickly dubbed the schoolgirl killings, were formally linked. The police rapidly established a joint investigation known as the Green Ribbon Task Force, tasked with finding the perpetrator. Forensic and pathological evidence immediately pointed to a shared, horrifying signature. The victims were young, targeted in the same area, sexually assaulted and tortured in captivity, and then murdered by strangulation. And the bodies were dumped in the same rural corridor, having been meticulously washed and altered, specifically with the removal of Kristen's hair and the dismemberment of Leslie. And this was done in order to impede the identifications. The investigation, however, was tragically hampered by rivalries between Toronto and the Niagara police forces because, you know, people just can't get over their fucking egos. And most damningly, by a catastrophic failure within the forensic system. The central agonizing point of failure lay in a file that had been sitting virtually untouched for over a year and a half. The police had been hunting a violent serial offender in Toronto, in the Toronto suburbs, known to the public and the press as the Scarborough Rapist. This individual was responsible for a reign of terror, committing at least 14 documented sexual assaults between 1987 and 1990. Crucially, Paul Bernardo had been on their radar for this case. In November of 1990, he had actually been interviewed by Metro Toronto police detectives because he had fit the physical description provided by one of these victims. And he even admitted to resembling the composite sketch of the Scarborough Rapist. As a routine measure, Bernardo voluntarily provided hair, blood, and saliva samples for DNA testing.
Damn.
So they had everything they needed from the very beginning.
Right.
But tragically, due to severe backlogs, limited funding, and a lack of priority at the Center of Forensic Sciences, the DNA sample given by Paul Bernardo in November of 1990 had never been processed.
Wow.
Yep. So while that crucial biological evidence sat on the shelf waiting for analysis, Bernardo and Homolka committed their final fatal crimes: the sexual assault and murder of Leslie Mahaffey in June of 1991, the kidnapping and murder of Kristen French in April 1992. In the years following, official inquiries would conclude that some of Bernardo's most heinous crimes could have been prevented had his DNA been analyzed in a timely manner. So the net began to close in, not with the brilliant police breakthrough, but with the inevitable implosion of Paul and Carla's violently destructive relationship. The abuse that Kala endured finally reached a breaking point in January of 1993, following a particularly vicious beating where Bernardo used a flashlight, leaving Kala with severe facial bruising and those two black eyes that I mentioned. She fled their St. Catherine's home. Then, on January 5th, 1993, Kala went to police and reported the assault. Paul Bernardo was subsequently arrested and charged with it, though he was quickly released on his own recognizance, which, well, fucking smart, guys.
Right.
With Kala physically separated from Paul and finally talking to detectives about his violence, the long-sought investigation accelerated dramatically. The psychological barrier of fear that had kept Kala silent was beginning to crack. Then, in February of 1993, the ultimate breakthrough arrived. The Center of Forensic Sciences finally processed Bernardo's DNA sample. The result was an undeniable, catastrophic match. Paul Bernardo was the Scarborough rapist. The single piece of evidence immediately put the prime suspect in the murders of Leslie Mahaffey and Christian French squarely in police sights for 24 other sex crimes. On February 17, 1993, police swarmed Bernardo's home and arrested him. He was initially charged with the serial rapes in Toronto. The charges were quickly expanded to include 2 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of aggravated sexual assault, and numerous other offenses related to the kidnapping and killings of Leslie and Kristen. The arrest of the killer, however, immediately thrust the investigation into its most controversial chapter. The desperate race to secure a confession and the fatal deal struck with his wife, a deal that has now become known as the deal with the devil. With Paul Bernardo facing multiple counts of first-degree murder, Crown prosecutors faced a daunting task. He was highly intelligent, manipulative, and had spent years carefully covering his tracks. They feared that without the direct, immediate testimony of Kala, they might not be able to secure a life sentence. A fear rooted in the difficulty of prosecuting a major, high-profile serial killer primarily on circumstantial evidence in Canada. Because at this point, that's all they have.
Right.
So, to ensure Bernardo was put away for life, they desperately felt they needed an eyewitness who was also an insider. Kala Homolka was charged with 2 counts of second-degree murder. But through her legal counsel, she proposed a shocking arrangement. Are you ready to get mad?
Sorry to piss me off.
Oh, this is going to just really piss you off.
Yay.
In exchange for her complete and honest testimony against Paul Bernardo, the Crown agreed to drop the murder charges. Homolka would instead plead guilty to the lesser charge of manslaughter in the deaths of Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French. She was sentenced to a mere 12 years in prison. The Crown formally referred to this arrangement as a cooperation agreement.
That's fucked, dude.
Crucially, the plea deal did not cover the death of Tammy Homolka, though. Due to the circumstances of Tammy's death, initially ruled an accidental overdose followed by choking, the Crown lacked the direct physical evidence and witness testimony required to secure a murder conviction against either Paul or Kala for that specific crime at the time.
Oh, my God.
The prosecutors publicly justified the deal by presenting Kala as primarily a battered wife, a terrified victim of profound, sustained domestic violence who had been coerced into compliance. They stressed that this difficult compromise was made to absolutely guarantee that Bernardo, whom they identified as the principal and far greater danger, would be locked away forever. A priority they felt superseded the prosecution of the secondary offender. The judge who accepted the plea noted that based only on the evidence presented to him by the Crown at that time, he had no legal choice but to ratify the agreement, which means based off what they had in that moment, he didn't have a reason not to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
So this plea bargain, finalized in May of 1993, caused an immediate and massive public outcry that spanned the entire country. The public was outraged by the perceived leniency of the sentence compared to the crimes Kala had confessed to witnessing and participating in. For the families of Kristen French and Leslie Mahaffey, the deal was described by their lawyer as a, quote, kick in the stomach and a profound betrayal of justice. The consensus was that the crown had sacrificed true justice for judicial expediency. The public anger was entirely justified. However, as the prosecution had unknowingly made a devastating error, they had struck the deal without knowing the full extent of Carla's true active involvement, which was about to be revealed in the most horrifying way imaginable. So they struck this deal fully believing she did everything she did because of his abuse against her.
Mm-hmm.
Like she didn't have a choice. Yeah. The fatal error for this prosecution began not with an arrest, but with a delivery. In May 1993, shortly after Carla's plea agreement was finalized, Paul Bernardo from jail provided his then defense attorney, Ken Murray, with written instructions detailing the exact hiding spot. Murray subsequently retrieved a box of hidden 8mm video cassettes from a false ceiling panel, specifically the bathroom ceiling on the second floor of the couple's home. This discovery immediately triggered an unprecedented legal and ethical crisis. Murray controversially held on to this evidence for 17 months, justifying the delay by citing the sanctity of client solicitor privilege. So client attorney privilege here. This decision deprived the crown of crucial evidence before the plea was sealed and led to such a profound legal disturbance that the Law Society of Upper Canada was later forced to formally change its rules on how defense lawyers must handle physical evidence of a crime. Because at the time, because Paul told him, this is what's on these tapes, this is where they're hidden, you need to go get them so they can't get them. If he would have then taken those tapes and handed them over, he's done. Mm-hmm. He's no longer a lawyer. His livelihood is gone.
Right.
That was the law at the time. So he's kind of stuck. What do I do? Do I give up my career? Or do I protect my client like I swore to do?
Mm-hmm.
When the tapes were finally turned over to the Crown in September 1994 by Bernardo's successor counsel, John Rosen. So this guy was like, whatever.
Right.
Career or not, you know. The contents exposed a truth far more sickening than anyone outside the couple's dark world had ever imagined. The tapes contained graphic footage of the kidnapping, torture, and sexual assault of Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French, as well as the assault on Jane Doe and the moments leading up to the death of Tammy Homolka. This discovery immediately and completely shattered the prosecution's entire premise for their plea deal. The footage revealed that Carla Homolka, to be far from the terrified, coerced victim that she had claimed to be. The legal earthquake that followed saw the Crown formally attempt to have Carla's plea arrangement vacated, arguing that it was based on her material omission of truth. However, the court ruled against the prosecution, upholding that 12-year sentence plea deal.
That's fucked.
The tapes proved the monumental error. They showed Homolka as an active, smiling, and willing participant in the abuse, administering drugs and physically assisting in restraint. And so, it was with this contaminated evidence and compromised star witness that the trial of Paul Bernardo finally began. The trial of the murders of Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French opened in May of 1995 in Toronto before Chief Justice Patrick Lesage. The proceedings were conducted under a massive publication ban. So it's like a gag order here. But in place primarily to protect Bernardo's rights to a fair trial by limiting access to the highly prejudicial videotape evidence. As the trial began, all eyes turned to the Crown's primary witness, Carla Homolka. As she testified over several days in June of 1995, Carla maintained her narrative of coercion, insisting she was too terrified to intervene while Bernardo strangled Mahaffey and French. But under the brutal cross-examination by Bernardo's lawyer, John Rosen, it's either Rosen or Rosen, I'm not sure, her story quickly frayed. Rosen argued the defense strategy that Homolka was the true calculating killer, hammered at her history of lies, forcing her to admit to key acts of willing participation, including fraudulently obtaining the drugs used on the victims and holding Kristen French down in the car during the abduction.
People that walk past our house when we do this probably think we're fucking crazy.
Rosin's strategy painted Carla as a cold, financially and emotionally motivated sadist who was trying to pin the actual strangulations on Bernardo. So his defense attorney is like, he didn't do it, she did. Even though there's videotape to show that he did it. But that's a defense attorney's job, I guess. Whatever. Yet, despite the chaos surrounding Homolka's credibility, the evidence against Bernardo was insurmountable. Videotape served as the central, irrefutable, and horrific proof. They were played for the jury, forcing the victim's parents to endure the unspeakable agony of watching their daughter's final hours. The tapes provided the only evidence necessary to charge and convict Bernardo for the sexual assault of the previously unidentified victim, Jane Doe, and forensically confirmed his identity as the Scarborough rapist. The footage visually demonstrated Bernardo's chilling determination as the principal aggressor. The trial concluded swiftly, the clarity of the visual evidence cutting through the legal noise. Prosecutor Ray Hallahan argued the jurors to look past the Homolka controversy. He asserted that even if they disregarded her entire testimony, the videotapes alone provided overwhelming proof that Paul Bernardo was guilty of the murders. The jury, reflecting the power of this evidence, returned their verdict in a remarkably short period of time. 14 hours. On September 1st, 1995, Paul Bernardo was convicted on all 9 counts he faced. This included 2 counts of first-degree murder. Bernardo himself showed no visible emotion, but outside the courthouse, the verdict was met with an emotional release. Tears, applause, and cheers from the massive crowd and victims' families. Chief Justice Lesage sentenced Bernardo to an automatic life imprisonment with a mandatory non-parole period of 25 years. Furthermore, the judge took the extraordinary step of declaring him a, quote, dangerous offender, a designation reserved for the most violent, high-risk repeat criminals. This decision, based on Bernardo's unrepentant psychopathic sadism, subjects him to indefinite detention, requiring a parole review every 2 years, effectively guaranteeing that he will never be released into society. The verdict finally delivered justice for Paul Bernardo's crimes, but the controversy of Carla Homolka's 12-year manslaughter sentence, which was, again, obtained before all of this came out, remained a very deep and permanent stain on the Canadian justice system. Immediately after, the public's attention shifted from the now-convicted killer to his accomplice, fueling years of continuous legal and ethical fallout. The focus turned, like I said, to Carla Homolka, who was held primarily at the Juliet Institution for Women in Quebec after beginning her sentence at the Kingston Prison for Women. Her 12-year sentence was the maximum possible for manslaughter conviction stemming from her controversial plea bargain. While incarcerated, she pursued a bachelor's degree in psychology. Mandy just rolled her eyes. Via correspondence. So I believe that means like via like
mail
order. Yeah. And she also began a controversial romantic relationship with another female inmate. She was repeatedly denied parole, ultimately serving her entire 12-year sentence. The media launched an intense period of surveillance dubbed Homolka Watch.
Damn.
How great is that?
Like a coffee drink.
It does, doesn't it?
This was created in the lead up to her release. Everybody's just waiting. Then on July 4th, 2005, Homolka was released from Juliet. And in an act designed to control the narrative, she granted an interview to CBC's French language service less than 2 hours after walking free. In this, she declared her intention to start her new life in French in Quebec, where the case had received relatively muted coverage. Basically, no one there knew her. To manage the immense public safety risk, she was made She was made subject to one of the most comprehensive peace bonds in Canadian history, imposing 14 strict conditions for 2 years. After her release, Homolka quickly began a new life under an assumed name. Initially settling in Quebec, she married, I'm going to say this wrong, Thierry Borelitis. I totally butchered that. It's French.
Let me see.
It's bold.
That sounds like a hemorrhoid cream.
You said it sounds like what?
A hemorrhoid cream.
It's right there at the top. It's bold.
Bordelais. Okay, that does not sound like a hemorrhoid cream.
No, it's not. I don't know what that sounds like, but it sounds nasty. Whatever it is. Anyway, this man, are you ready for this?
Yeah.
He was the brother to her former lawyer. Mandy's mouth just hit the floor. Oh, yep. After they got married, she then began using the name Leanne Tayel or Leanne Bordup. How do you say it?
Bordelais.
So this bitch done changed her name twice since she got out.
Shit, I went to hell.
Now, listen to this.
Okay.
Because this is really going to piss you off. After being discovered by media, working briefly at a hardware store in a Montreal suburb, she and her husband left Canada around 2007 or 2008. Relocating to the Caribbean island of Guadalupe or the Antilles. While there, the couple had 3 children. They remained abroad for nearly a decade, but by 2014, the family returned to the Quebec area, eventually settling in the Montreal suburb of... I should have looked up how to say this. Chateauguay? Sorry, our Canadian listeners. I know I totally said that wrong. The family's presence in the community was revealed by a media investigation in 2016, sparking immediate and intense public outrage. Doesn't even fit. Okay, are you ready?
Yeah.
Homolka was reportedly living as a stay-at-home mother, and her children attended a local school, forcing the school board to issue letters to parents to reassure them about the children's safety, though legally Homolka had served her time and was free to live where she chose. So, these letters were sent out because she would volunteer at the school.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And another parent at the school figured out who she really was.
Yeah. You would think that would...
Your face is plastered all over news media.
But you would think that would be one of her conditions since the kid...
But it was only for 2 years.
Yeah, but you would think that would
after that
permanently.
Yeah, but this is Canada. They don't even have the death penalty.
Oh, well, then...
Which he should have got.
If that had been here in the U.S., then he would have got it. And she would have been on the sex offender registry for life. Wouldn't have even been allowed at the school. But it's Canada. Their laws are different, especially during this time.
Yeah.
But that's how they figured out and had to send those letters out. Yeah. Meanwhile, Paul Bernardo began his life sentence in the shadow of the same public fury. He was declared a dangerous offender in 1995 and spent the first 28 years of his sentence in maximum security institutions. First at Kingston Penitentiary until its closure in 2013, then at Millhaven Institution. He was confined to his cell for 23 hours a day as a no-contact offender. For nearly 2 decades, he was deemed an inmate in danger and held in involuntary segregation for his own protection. So,
yeah, because them bad boys would hurt him.
For 20 years, he was in isolation
mm-hmm.
by himself. Where you should be. Although internal assessments constantly showed he met the criteria for transfer to a medium security facility. So according to these assessments, they're like, oh, no, he doesn't need to be a maximum. He can go to medium. The fuck he can.
Right.
The So the SRS, which is the security reclassification scale, recommended that he be moved to medium security 14 separate times. Prison officials repeatedly overrode the score, citing public safety concerns and the need for his own protection from other inmates. Mm-hmm. So they're like, no, there are multiple reasons why this guy needs to stay here. Furthermore, his legal challenges failed at every single stage. His attempts to overturn his conviction were consistently rejected, and his final application for leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada was definitively dismissed on September 21st, 2000. Despite avoiding violence against staff or other inmates, he had been found with unauthorized contraband, including a homemade shank and razor blade on separate occasions. So this motherfucker's by himself.
Right.
And he's still making, like, who are you going to stab? The wall? Like, I'm going to get mad and stab my bed over here. Like, I don't understand. So the political firestorm surrounding his incarceration returned 2 years ago in 2023 when the Correctional Service of Canada transferred Bernardo to the medium security institution La Macasa in Quebec, a move that, while following protocol, was publicly condemned by top politicians and the victims' families. In a bizarre and profound twist, during Bernardo's confinement, the killer made confessions that revealed a significant miscarriage of justice. In 2005 and 2006, following Homolka's release, Bernardo informed police that he was responsible for at least 10 more sexual assaults that had not been previously ascribed to the Scarborough rapist. Crucially, one of these confessions was for an attack that had wrongfully convicted another man, Anthony Hanmeyer. Might be Meyer. There's two A's in it, so I'm not sure. Sorry. This 1987 knife assault on a 15-year-old girl led to the wrongful conviction of this man in October of 1989, based solely, can you guess?
I don't even want to. I'm pissed.
On a mistaken eyewitness identification.
Wow.
Despite his innocence, he was urged to plead guilty to avoid a lengthy sentence and served 16 months in prison. After Bernardo's detailed confession was confirmed by police in April of 2006, police failed to disclose this life-changing information to Anthony, delaying his exoneration. The truth was finally uncovered by lawyers from Innocence Canada, which is like our Innocence Project, leading the Ontario Court of Appeal to formally acquit Anthony of the crime on June 25th, 2008. Nearly 21 years after the assault. So decades after the trial, the two figures at the center of the case remain in starkly different circumstances. Paul Bernardo is currently incarcerated in La Macasa Institution in Quebec. This facility is a medium security federal prison, a transfer that occurred, like I said, May of 2023 from the maximum security Millhaven Institution in Ontario. This move sparked a major political controversy, but was internally upheld by the Correctional Service of Canada as compliant with policy, noting that Bernardo's high risk profile meant that he would remain under tight controls despite the reclassification. Bernardo, who holds a dangerous offender designation, is serving a life sentence and has been denied parole multiple times, making his ultimate release highly unlikely. In contrast, Carla Moco lives in freedom under an assumed identity. After her unconditional release in 2005, she quickly resumed a private life, adopting her Leanne name. She married Terry, and initially moved out of the country, like I said, to the Caribbean island of Guadalupe, or the Antilles, where the couple had three children. Then they returned to Canada. Media reports from 2016 confirmed that Homolka and her family were residing in that Montreal suburb of Quebec, where she lives as a stay-at-home mother. As she served her full sentence, she is legally free and is not subject to parole or monitoring conditions anymore. Her presence in the community, particularly as her children attended local schools, had continued to cause major public concern and outrage, which, yeah.
I mean, yeah.
I'd be pissed. Mm-hmm. So beyond the individual fates of the perpetrators, the intense public outrage and legal complexities of the case resulted in several enduring changes and ethical debates that left a permanent legacy on Canadian law and their criminal justice system. The initial investigation itself was scrutinized. An official inquiry found significant police missteps, including a 26-month delay in processing Bernardo's DNA sample taken in November of 1990. A period during which Leslie Mahaffey, Kristen French, and Tammy Homolka were murdered. So had they tested that DNA, all three of those girls would still be alive. The handling of the evidence became a controversy in itself, as Bernardo's first lawyer, Ken Murray, withheld the incriminating videotapes for 16 months. While Murray was eventually acquitted of obstruction of justice, the case brought national attention to the need for clarity, leading the Law Society of Upper Canada to approve new rules of professional conduct, explicitly prohibiting the concealment or alteration of incriminating physical evidence from either the prosecution or the defense. The case has also served as a flashpoint for constitutional and criminal law reform. The extensive publication ban imposed to protect Bernardo's rights to a fair trial led to intense legal debate, with media outlets fighting the ban and foreign newspapers being bootlegged into Canada to provide the public with details in Homolka's plea deal, establishing the case as a defining moment in the constitutional balance between the freedom of the press and the fair trial rights of the accused. The fact that the horrifying crimes were captured on video made it the first instance in Canadian history where such graphic digital media was a central component in court proceedings, forcing the legal system to grapple with the admissibility and traumatic impact of video evidence. Finally, the tragedy drove lasting legislative changes focused on victims' rights and offender management. The outrage that Bernardo's police in parole ineligibility was not increased for the second murder fueled national calls for reform concerning consecutive sentences for multiple murders. More directly, the fear that Carla Homolka would become eligible to apply for a criminal pardon led to the swift passage of laws in 2010 that extended the waiting periods for pardons for serious crimes and empowered the parole board to reject any application that would, quote, bring the administration of justice into disrepute. I don't know why my brain wouldn't process that word. Now, even decades later, that public outcry over Paul Bernardo's transfer to the medium security prison prompted subsequent orders from the public safety minister to tighten federal transfer policies for high-profile violent offenders, ensuring that the emotional and ethical stain of the case continues to shape Canadian penal policy. The crimes of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka have left a permanent, unhealing scar on the Canadian conscience. What began as a local investigation into missing teens evolved into a national trauma that exposed flaws in the police, the prosecution, and the legal framework, ultimately driving significant lasting change. Which is sad. Like, shit like this should not happen for you to see that there is something wrong and you need to fix it.
Right.
It's ridiculous. Makes me so mad. So the profound legal legacy of this case is defined by an ongoing struggle to balance the rights of the accused against the emotional needs and physical safety of the public and victims. This struggle fueled the reckoning of the justice system, beginning with major reforms to offender management. Public fury over Homolka's release and the hypothetical chance of her applying for a record suspension led directly to federal legislative action. The government amended pardon laws to include a longer wait period, like I said, and introduced a clause allowing the parole board to reject any of them. The trial judge's designation of Bernardo as a sexually sadistic psychopath cemented the dangerous offender status as the legal mechanism for ensuring the most severe permanent incapacitation within Canada's justice system for its most extreme criminals. The intense suffering of the Mahaffey and French families also forced a judicial reckoning with the marginal role of victims in the criminal process as well. As the judge's unusual decision to grant the family standing in the court and was an early critical step toward empowering victims and ultimately contributing to a national movement for greater victim participation and standing. Beyond the courtroom, the case also triggered profound changes to professional conduct in the legal and investigative circles. Controversy surrounding Bernardo's first lawyer The sheer horror of the crimes and the enduring shock of Carla Homolka's comparatively light sentence, a deal with the devil necessary for conviction, ensured that this case remains a touchstone for discussions on judicial discretion, the limits of plea bargaining, the ethics of legal defense, and the paramount importance of prioritizing the protection of Canadian children. So while Paul Bernardo remains behind bars, Carla Homolka lives in freedom under a new identity, the legacy of their terror continues to shape the laws that protect the most vulnerable within Canada. The saga of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka has thus settled into a grim duality. The killer remains locked away under permanent legal constraint, fighting for the right to move within his own prison walls, while the accomplice lives in freedom under an assumed identity abroad, a deeply unsettling permanent scar on the Canadian conscience. And that is our case on the Ken and Barbie killers.
How did the guy, why would the guy even marry her and have kids with her?
That is a good fucking question.
It's not like he didn't know.
Right.
If he didn't, then he surely he found out soon enough.
Right. That's a good question. Like, that's my question. Like, I want to know.
Like,
why?
You're a sick fuck, my guy. She did it to her own sister. What makes you think she won't do it to her own fucking
kids? Right, exactly. Right.
Women do that all the time. Women marry convicts all the time.
It's weird. I don't understand it at all.
Yeah, but I'm talking
it's fucking weird.
She helped rape and kill young girls and her...
And then her own sister. Like, right. It's so weird.
It's not like he married somebody that's in life for prison.
Right.
In prison for life. Like, he married her.
She is out here and has access and can do it all over again. I don't understand the mentality of that at all. I don't get it.
Somebody that's in life in prison, cool, because then you ain't ever really got to deal with them. You just go visit them once a month and send them some letters.
Right. Like, all the girls that were, like, obsessed with Ted Bundy. The fuck is wrong with you? Like, the mentality, I don't understand it. For this guy, I don't understand it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's good that we don't understand it. Our brains can't go there.
Yeah. It's just a little safe.
Right, exactly. So there are some movies. There are some books out there if anybody wants to dive into it on their own. There are some things that are different, which the movie is called Carla, which that's how I heard. That's where I learned about this case at. I watched it like forever ago. So there's some things that aren't necessarily accurate, but like the family room is in like the real house was in the basement.
On the couch, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So I've seen it.
Have you seen it? It's called Carla. Yeah. It's her face on the cover.
Yeah. When you started talking about it, I was like, fuck, I seen a movie like that. Mm-hmm. They were on the couch or something. Yeah. Like that. So
the family room in the movie is upstairs on the main level, but in the real house, it's in the basement. It's little things like that that are different.
Right.
There are a lot of things that, you know, I just told you about that aren't in the movie because you do have to be careful about it. So there's a bunch of those out there. You can go watch all those. But that's it for this one. That's all I got.
That's crazy, man.
That's pretty fucked
up. Your own fucking sister.
Right.
I need to do it, period.
But then your own sister, your baby sister at that. Yeah.
Can you help? Like, you're a sick fuck.
And it's all on video, every bit of it.
Fucking, I couldn't. Oh, that would make me.
The girl that plays Carla in that movie, Carla. You know, the girl that played Donna on that 70s show, she plays Carla in that movie. I just can't remember her name. But everybody will know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
She did really good in that part. Like, she really did. Yep. That's all we got for this one. Any final thoughts?
This is Neil. She only got 12 years. And then she was proud to have kids and change her name and be in society and work at the school. Like,
for all we know, she's living somewhere under a third name.
She probably changed it.
I don't think so.
I Googled it, though, to see what they look like in 2025. And there's not... Oh, very many pictures of her for 2025.
I bet she's probably hidden in all somewhere. They're saying
that she looks like a soccer mom. Mm,
yeah, I heard that
on there.
Okay, I got the sketch. This is the sketch of the Scarborough rapist, and that's Paul Bernardo. Which all of these are going to be on Facebook for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So how they didn't like? I don't know. But yeah, that's it, guys. So we'll be back on Friday
with a new case. So don't forget to subscribe so you get that notification when it comes out, so you don't miss that one. Give us a rate, review. As always, that helps us find new listeners. And then until then, we hope you keep listening. And remember to
watch for monsters.
And don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.